Well, it's nice to see you again.
Nice to see you.
Last time we chatted, it was on the occasion of Caracole.
Right.
And we also did a boy's story.
And States of Desire, too, I think.
No, we didn't do
States of
Desire.
No, we didn't do that. Uh-huh. No. Mm-hmm.
But we've kept in contact for the last three books or so. I think a nice way to start is to reintroduce you to the audience. And, of course, I do this in a different way. You know, I don't take this tape. I cut and edit and splice and all this and make news reports out of it. But your hero, so to speak, your narrator, was introduced in A Boy's Own Story. And so I was going to suggest that perhaps you just give me a little synopsis, just to fill us in a little bit about that portion of your character's life. He doesn't have a name, does he?
No. In A Boy's Own Story, we follow him from very early childhood, actually, until age 16. And certainly we see the emergence of his feeling that he is gay. But in fact, he doesn't really meet any gay people. He has some sexual brushes with people. But basically, he feels extraordinarily alien, very, very worried about himself. He starts going to a psychiatrist. He asks to be sent away to a boarding school on the theory that if he escapes his mother's influence, that somehow he'll become better, he'll be cured. And he's very much in the Midwest, while always longing to leave, to go to New York, to have a different life. And I think there's also a whole side of him that's longing to be among people who are more cultured, and he has some sort of artistic leanings. In this book,
just back up a second. So that took him up through his 16th year.
Right.
Now, when you finished that book, had it been in your mind that you might pick up the story at some distant point?
Yes.
So you actually, this was...
Yes.
Yeah.
I thought of that because it seemed to me an obvious thing to do, and I think I left it at a turning point in the sense that the boy... who I think is extraordinarily sympathetic during the earlier part of the book, for most of the book, actually turns rather nasty at the end. He turns quite nasty, in fact. He betrays a teacher of his with whom he's had some sort of sexual encounter. He turns him in. And this weird sort of backstabbing is like the first sign that he isn't completely passive, that there's a lot of anger within him, misdirected as it is. And it's a kind of becoming adult in the sense that he's lost his illusions, that he's become aggressive, although it doesn't make any sense at all. And one of the things I wanted to show was the kind of internalized self-oppression that homosexuals had in that period. And that certainly continues in this book, which, however, has a much happier ending.
Well, now several years pass between that book and this The Beautiful Room is Empty, and including the publication of another novel, which was, of course, like a fairy tale. It's nothing like these books. Mm-hmm. And, of course, you moved to Paris, and you began working, I believe you began to work as a correspondent for Vanity Fair, wasn't it?
And for Vogue, for Condé Nast in general. I do stories for The Traveler.
Are you still in Paris, by the way?
Yes, I still am. And I'm, although I've just come back from a 6-week trip to Australia and New Zealand, where I was also promoting this book, The Beautiful Room Is Empty, which, by the way, went number one on the bestseller list in England.
Congratulations.
Yeah.
That's great. What is the focus of your reporting for the Condé Nast papers?
Well, all different kinds of things. I like to be versatile and do different things. For instance, just in the last few weeks, I've done a story on the first great house that Le Corbusier built. This one happened to be near Geneva, near Neuchâtel in Switzerland. I went and interviewed the lady who owns it and who's just restored it. I did a story on the two fellows who played in the movie Maurice, the M. Forster movie, Morris, and who now have made a Handful of Dust, based on Evelyn Waugh's novel, and which will come out in June. And I went to Petra, which is in Jordan, and I went to Syria and Jordan and did a story for The Traveler on Petra, which is this marvelous city, the rose-red city half as old as time, that was abandoned and forgotten for over 1,000 years.
So they don't have you on the gay beat. I mean, you have the versatility of covering a variety of subjects.
No, not at all. But I write an enormous amount of journalism. For instance, I just did a long essay on Truman Capote for the TLS in London, and I've done a lot of reviewing for the London Times, the Sunday London Times. I just did a piece for the Sunday Times here. I mean, it will come out next week. I'm always cranking them out.
Well, you really are.
Yeah.
And the novels. Well, then about a year and a half, 2 years ago, you sat down, I guess, to start writing the new book and to bring your character back. What is the significance of the title, The Beautiful Room is Empty?
Well, it's a line from a letter that Kafka sent to his girlfriend Milena, who was a Czech girl, and they had a rather unhappy love affair, most of it conducted through the mail. And Kafka felt that they were like two people standing on the opposite sides of the same room, and that when one of them would come into the room, the other one would dart behind his door, and that sometimes they were both so skitterish that both of them be hiding behind their doors at the same moment, and the beautiful room is empty. And my idea is that in the pre-liberation period, that is before 1969 in the Stonewall Uprising, which was the beginning of gay liberation, that there were a lot of good friendships amongst gay men and lesbians, but that the love affairs were lousy. And because I think it was very difficult to sustain that much intimacy if you hated yourself. In other words, at that point, there were only three possible definitions for homosexuals. You were either a criminal, a sinner, or neurotic. I mean, there was the medical definition, the legal, or the religious. And so it was very hard to have any kind of self-esteem. There was no other way of viewing oneself. And so I think that that was a very corrosive influence on love affairs, which just didn't work very well. So anyway, that's the beautiful room. That is the potential relationship amongst two people, between two people, that just didn't work, that was empty.
And the beautiful room is empty. Your character goes to college, University of Michigan, joins a fraternity, develops a number of relationships, winds up in New York, and is on Christopher Street at the time of the Stonewall Uprising. The book is shocking in many respects because of the promiscuous nature of your character. For example, he is a person who, during his college years, going to the student center, hanging out in the public bathrooms. Now, why would he do that?
Well, I think that the truth is that I was trying to think about the other day. I was thinking when I was actually in college, I don't think I knew or ever was introduced to a single pair of gay men. I mean, that is, gay lovers. I had no picture of what that would be like. Although I met many gay people, it was almost always furtively, we were all ashamed of what we were. In other words, when you couldn't stand the pressure of sexual desire anymore, you would go to an anonymous place like that, have quick sex, but pretend you didn't recognize each other, and never even give a flicker of an eyebrow when you saw that person again in the hallways of the school. That's still going on, by the way. I mean, you'd be surprised how many universities, that's the typical thing. In other words, there are a lot of kids at that age who don't accept that they're homosexual, who are still dating girls, though their longings are all for members of their own sex, and who are finding some sort of sexual relief in what's really not a very pleasant context. There are also a tremendous number of married men who have sex either in these little pornographic film theaters where they go in, they're just these little booths where they watch these dirty movies and they have sex with each other in those booths, or at the rest stops along the highways. You know, that's whenever there's an arrest in one of those places, and they still happen rather frequently, the names of the people will be printed, and it's always tragic because most of them are married, and it will lead to suicides, destroy the rest of the family. It's a pretty sad thing. I think it's just a sign of the continuing oppression. And another thing, from a health point of view, the most difficult group to reach right now are these people? The one, I mean, in terms of AIDS education. Because since they don't think of themselves as gay, and since they have no contact with the gay community except in this occasional sexual context, they're not very easily reachable for safe sex education. And what's interesting is that people who identify themselves as gay have changed their, in the United States, have changed their sexual behavior enormously. Of the new cases of AIDS, that is, let's put it this way, new people who are entering the gay community, only 1% of them are showing up positive for the virus. In other words, a tiny amount, much smaller than the heterosexual population in general, and certainly the drug-using part of the heterosexual population. So in other words, a massive re-education has happened in the last 5 years amongst gay men, but that's within the gay community. But the danger spots are the 18 to 22-year-olds who either feel they're invulnerable or who feel they're in love, and then love forgives everything, and therefore you don't have to observe safe sex rules, or they feel they're magical, nothing will ever touch them, or they're in this group of people who only engage in anonymous sex but still define themselves socially and psychologically in their own minds as heterosexual.
Well, but back to the book and use the term anonymous sex. Some of the sex was done with people that were only their genitals were seen under transoms and things like that, and the degrading aspect of it seems to me frightening from an emotional standpoint, because here is a young gay man who is already living with this and feels confused by it, and you mentioned the term cure, mm-hmm. and doing these things which just are degrading. And how does one reconcile it? Even after your character gets to New York, he goes out late at night, cruising the streets, mm-hmm. looking for anonymous people to do it with. How does one reconcile that and have an adjusted life, emotionally adjusted? Maybe I'm not phrasing this very well, but when you're doing something that is counter to what society expects anyway, mm-hmm. that's one thing. Mm-hmm. But then to try to reconcile the degrading aspects of it.
I think some distinctions are worth making here. I mean, I think that there are people, both heterosexual and homosexual, who are nest builders. That is, they like to find one person and with whom they build a life. Sometimes they are serially monogamous, that is, they have a partner for 4 or 5 years to whom they're more or less faithful, then they find another one to whom they're more or less faithful. But anyway, at any given moment, they're monogamous and that's what they prefer, and that's a lot of people. But there's an awfully large group of people, both heterosexual men and homosexual men, especially men, who are excitement seekers, who are not nest builders, and they like to have lots of sexual adventures, and if they don't have them, they feel very unhappy. Now, I think that there are a lot of things then that enter at this point. If you're going to have lots of random sexual adventures, they need not be anonymous. That is, they can be with a partner that you pick up in a bar and you spend the night with him or her. But I think that the present health situation, again, has made that almost impractical. Unless one is very, very good about practicing safe sex techniques. Anyway, I don't find that degrading, frankly. I don't find people...
Having sex in a urinal?
I find that degrading. But I don't find having lots of sex with people, a different one every night, in bed, at home, having a date with somebody, many dates, I don't find that degrading. But I think what happens is that the people that you're going to find in the urinals are people who have not come out. That is, the gay men that you'll find in those situations are basically, as I say, married men. That's the largest group. And other than that, it'll be people who don't think that they're gay. I mean, they don't accept their sexuality.
Now, the story in The Beautiful Room is empty. It's not reconciled, of course, at the end, because we can expect this to go further. But it does end with the rebellion on Christopher Street. Were you actually a part of that?
I was.
Mm-hmm. Did it happen the way you describe it in the book? Tell me a little bit about that.
Yes, it was interesting. I mean, I think that we had no idea at the time that we were witnessing a historical changed. I suppose people never do. Probably the people who were at the Bastille didn't know that anything was really happening. Tolstoy says that at the Battle of Borodino, nobody quite figured out what was happening, that it was important. Anyway, it was a disco. It was a big one. It was a play. It was in the village on Christopher Street, where a bagel shop is now. It was a place where, right across from Sheridan Square, it was a place where a lot of black and Puerto Rican guys would go, who were a pretty tough crowd. Even the drag queens were pretty tough. Most of them were street fighters who knew how to handle themselves. And it was a big bar. It was a hot night. It was in late June. Judy Garland had just died, and everybody's nerves were very overwrought because she was a great hero, particularly to that class of boys at that time. And anyway, the police had been raiding bars a few years earlier quite consistently during the World's Fair. They were always trying to clean up the city so that it would look attractive to visitors during the World's Fair. But after the World's Fair, all that was allowed to sort of lapse, and gay bars began to spring up like mushrooms, and the police really didn't hassle anybody very much. But then suddenly, here it was, on this night, when everybody's hanging out on the stoop, and in the previous 2 years, Christopher Street has become very much identified as the gay street. In a city of thousands and thousands of streets, this is the one street where gays are allowed to hang out. And most of the boutiques, the businesses, are gay for the space of about three or four blocks. Anyway, the police raided it. They had there were so many employees in this bar. They were only taking away the employees, but so many bartenders that they could only take half of them in the Black Mariah the first time. So they left the other half with a couple cops inside as a kind of fortress affair while we were all driven out onto the street. And instead of dispersing into the night, as gay people had always done before, we were angry. We were angry that our favorite bar had been taken away for no good reason. We were angry at the prospect that a new wave of this kind of police torment was going to start. So we fought back. And
overturned cars.
Yep. And it went on for a couple of days. And at one point, all Sheridan Square was cordoned off, and cars weren't allowed to go through it, which is a major artery, 7th Avenue in New York. So it was quite a situation.
That was 68.
69.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that what had influenced it were things like black liberation, the student rebellion, and women's liberation. All these things, I mean, in other words, there were a tremendous amount of changes that were happening at that time, of course, in the 60s. And I think we patterned ourselves perhaps most on black liberation at first, because the popular slogan at that time was black is beautiful, and we started saying gay is good. But the minute we said it, we started laughing, because the idea that there would be anything good about being homosexual was so unthinkable in those days. I mean, we were so used to thinking of ourselves as sick, you know. And I can remember in the early 60s that no matter how pleasant an evening you might be spending with your friends, there was always a kind of obligatory moment during the course of the evening when you'd have to say, oh, God, we're all so sick. But suddenly, I think that women's liberation had come along, and it had suggested that the what appeared to be the classic and normal and natural and eternal relationships between men and women, with men oppressing women, that didn't need to continue, that could be changed. And then I think that blacks had demanded their rights. And so things that had appeared to be eternal in the 50s and part of the natural order were getting overturned all around us. And then I think suddenly gays felt, well, they could demand their rights too.
Well, now you mentioned feeling sick. We're so sick. But indeed, in your novel, your hero and his friend both decide to go straight.
Mm-hmm.
And to make an effort to do it. How does one do that, though?
It doesn't work very well, unfortunately. I think there are some people who are genuinely bisexual, but they're very few. And I think that most people, as the like myself, like the boy in these two books of mine, even at a very young age in A Boy's Own Story, he's very, very aware that he's exclusively drawn to men in an erotic way, though he has lots of women friends.
Well, he also has a sexual relation with Maria, I believe.
Yeah, that's right.
I think it was a one-time deal.
But. Yeah, and I think it's more that he feels so much for her. It's obviously a great friendship, and he can't really define what he feels. I mean, he doesn't know whether it's friendship or what. It's one of those very passionate friendships, and it spills over into sex. Also, I think it would be very nice for him if it could turn into a sexual affair. Obviously, if anybody had the choice, it's easier to be heterosexual than to be homosexual. I mean, if you could choose to be heterosexual, you would. It's just easier. It's just like I imagine most people would choose to be white rather than black. I mean, there are just too many problems with either being black or gay. But once you are gay or once you are black, you really become proud of your culture and you enter into it and you like it. It marks you so much you can't even imagine how you would be otherwise.
Yeah, it's hard enough being heterosexual with all of the emotional conflicts that one has with the opposite sex. And just living in general, but gays have almost the same problems. Plus, they have difficulty in equating with society or how society sees them. Although, obviously, there has been society has liberalized to a tremendous degree, so that you and I can sit here and talk about this.
Exactly.
I think that 20 years ago, you may not have wanted to talk about it, or if you did, it would be in a furtive way on the air, couched with all sorts of euphemisms. I mean, we wouldn't talk about having sex in urinals.
Well, this book, The Beautiful Room is Empty, I used the same title and some of the same storyline, though an entirely different treatment, in a book I wrote in the 60s, when I was actually living through this period. And that book went to 22 publishers in New York, and it was turned down by every one of them, and it was never published. And I would later, after Gay Liberation, frequently meet editors in big publishing houses who would say to me, you know, I read that book of yours, The Beautiful Room is Empty, and I really liked it, but I didn't dare speak out for it, because if I had, people would have known I was gay. So, I mean, in other words, there was a lot of oppression by gays of other gays out of fear.
But what you're saying is that if somebody buys a gay book, then he must be gay. But that's not necessarily the case now.
No. Well, what I'm saying is that not only would we not have been talking about this book 20 years ago on the radio, this book wouldn't have been published, because this book was being submitted in some form or other 20 years ago, too, and it wasn't getting published. I mean, people were afraid of it.
But as an editor at Knopf, I mean, hypothetically, if I were an editor at Knopf and you sent me the manuscript, mm-hmm. of course, I'm not gay, but, I mean, I would look at the book in terms of the book.
Yeah.
And I think, who was your editor at Knopf?
Sonny Mehta.
Well, I mean, he's not gay.
No.
As far as I know. I mean, I shouldn't say that. I mean, I don't know. I know. But he and his wife do a lot of partying.
Right.
So,
Sonny was my editor in England and had a big success with my books there. He launched a Boys Own Story there, which, and I think he did it very well, because it never was typed as a book just for gays there, and it went on to sell 125,000 copies in England, which is a lot. And I think the people it was mainly reaching were heterosexual teenagers, because it's really a teenage book. And then this book, The Beautiful Room is Empty in England, also has gone number one in the bestseller list. So I think that what has happened is that people in England, I think I'm taken as a writer, not as a gay writer. And it was a little bit of a shock for me this time, coming back from... this book was first launched in England, then in Australia, then New Zealand, and only finally in America, just because of a scheduling problem. Anyway, it was a little bit of a shock for me to arrive from those three countries, having promoted it there, to America, where, although I'm doing this show, which is a national show, and I'm happy to do it with you, I can't tell you that how disappointed I was that almost all the coverage is all little tiny neighborhood gay papers, maybe some gay program that's on at 4 in the morning for 10 minutes, you know, that kind of thing. In other words, having been interviewed by every major paper in Australia and New Zealand, having been on the same platform with Margaret Drabble, Victoria Glendening, Julian Barnes, you know, being treated like a real writer, and being introduced to all the top writers in Australia, then to suddenly come here and be put back in my ghetto. I mean, America ghettoizes people. And I think that there's something shocking about that. It's really a breakdown in what democracy is all about.
Are you saying our attitudes in this country are different than those, say, in Australia?
Absolutely.
They treat you differently?
Very differently. I gave a reading in Australia to 300 women, in which I read some of these toilet scenes that you're mentioning, you know, and I said, now, ladies, this is an X-rated reading, and you should leave now if you have thin skins, but I'm going to tell you some things about sex and what men do together and all that. Well, they loved it. They were fascinated. But these were very progressive women who, I mean, I think women in Australia are pretty much the culture bearers, and pretty much the progressive political element, too.
Well, I hope what you say about America is somewhat of an exaggeration spoken by an anxious artist who's always worried about his book. But I see the book as a book about gays, but I don't see it as a gay book. Mm-hmm. I don't think it's geared to gays any more than Kara Cole was geared to gays.
Mm-hmm.
I think, the wonderful thing about books is that we learn from them.
I think so, too. But, like, when you enter a bookshop in America, you go, you see... They're oftentimes organized according to gay studies, women's studies, black studies. Now, does that mean a woman is not supposed to go over and buy something in a gay studies? Does it mean that a white gay is not supposed to go buy something in black studies? I mean, this is ridiculous. I mean, the reason we read Toni Morrison's books is to find out what it's like to be black. And I think that when I was a kid and I read Richard Wright's Native Son, it was the first real strong feeling I ever had of how to get into black skin and be black for the course of reading that book. And it was a tremendous experience for me. And I think that I had the same pleasure in reading Virginia Woolf's books and understanding a certain kind of female sensibility. But I just think that it's shocking the way that we're getting more and more ghettoized, I think, in this country.
I thought we were getting less ghettoized.
I don't know. Compared to other countries, it seems to me that we're very...
But this is a mainstream book, getting mainstream reviews. This mm-hmm. may wind up in a gay section in a year from now, mm-hmm. when it's no longer a new book. But I'm sure that if we went over to B. Dalton, mm-hmm. This book is going to be right up there with all of the other new books.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't that true? I mean, I haven't checked it. I haven't checked its space. Most writers who publish a book do sneak into bookstores to see where they've located the book. And in fact, I was talking to Roy Blunt a while ago. He was in Barnes & Noble. He had a book out a while back, and so he stood there watching his book, you know, waiting for somebody to buy it, you know. And he concluded that a watched book never sells.
Oh, very good. That's very good.
So you have to leave. You'd have to leave for it to sell. But it's a mainstream. Okay?
Yeah.
But it's a mainstream book. And while you might find it on a bookshop near Christopher Street, it would be understandable, but you're going to find it in all the major stores. Isn't that true?
No, I mean, I'm not complaining about my own treatment. I mean, I think it's been very good. And for instance, Newsweek does an article on, it's called Out of the Closets, Onto the Shelves, about the kind of revolution in gay publishing. And Walter Clemens in that article said that I was the best known gay writer in the world. Well, that's very nice for me, because wherever I've gone, people have quoted this article to me, and newspaper stories have quoted it, and I'm sure it's one reason why I've gotten a lot of publicity on this book. However, I mean, I just point out that I am being called a gay writer, and it is in an article about gay things, and it's pretty tightly quarantined like that. Whereas, for instance, in France, where my books appear, and in England, where my books appear, in France, you can read a review of my books and not even be aware that the content is gay. I mean, it is really amazing how they go over backwards to not isolate people. I mean, for instance, like, Before She Died, Simone Signoret published a Jewish novel, what we would call a Jewish novel, all about the experience of Jews. But she refused to accept the label Jewish novelist. She said, I'm a novelist, I'm not a Jewish novelist. I'm Jewish, I'm a novelist, I write about Jews, but I'm not a Jewish novelist. In the same way, Tahar Benjaloun, who won the Prix Goncourt this year in France, he's an Arab, he writes about Arabs, but he won't let himself be called an Arab novelist. He's a French novelist. And in other words, it's a highly centralized society. One out of six French people lives in Paris. There's a tremendous feeling of unity within the country, and everyone wants to read novels about other French people and their different experiences. It's a way of reinforcing the centralism, I suppose, of that society. Whereas our society, which is so scattered geographically and so scattered in terms of its class system and its racial makeup and so on, I think just keeps splintering more and more, I feel. And I feel that literature even reflects that. So, like, you have a West Coast literature now, which is all this New Age consciousness. If you went into a West Coast bookshop, you wouldn't recognize any of the titles. I mean, you wouldn't see the titles that are being brought out here that we're talking about as being bestsellers. They have all that kind of guru stuff that they read out there. And it's entirely different. And they see a complete East Coast conspiracy, because East Coast people, maybe this very book program, refuse to recognize the importance of all those writers, who to them are the great writers. There's all kinds of little ethnic and geographical enclaves in this country, and it seems like the best books in each of those categories doesn't really reach into the mainstream. I don't feel we have a general reader in America anymore. I don't think there's one cultured woman, 50 years old, who speaks several languages, who's traveled to Europe, who's interested in everything, who's going to sit down and read my book, and then Updike's book, and then Toni Morrison's book. I hope there's such a person.
I do.
You do.
I go from one to another.
Right.
Well, Edmund White, I'm going to look forward to seeing how your character develops toward middle age. I hate to call him your character, your narrative. Can't you give him a name like Billy or something like that, so I could say Bill or something like that, so he's got an identity that we can talk about? Your character doesn't sound right.
It does sound odd, doesn't it? Well, maybe I will give him a name in the next one.
Well, I'm looking forward to reading it and looking forward to having you back. We'll talk again.
Okay, thanks a lot.